Welcome to Growth Marketing Today, where marketers, designers, and product owners level up their growth marketing chops from experts in today's top startups. Here's your host, Ramley John.
As growth marketers, data is king. Data, 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 data everywhere. How do you make sense of it as a growth marketer? In this episode, I have somebody special. I have Nick Drew. He is currently the CEO of a data agency called Fuse Insights, but he's previously had data and research roles at Yahoo, Microsoft, Financial Times. So this guy's legit. He's going to give insights on forming data-driven growth strategies. In this episode, you're going to learn Nick's process for gathering and developing actionable insights from data, why curiosity is the most important thing when interpreting data, why more data might actually be a bad thing. Yeah, that's true. More isn't always better. If you want high-level outline and quotes from this episode, go to growthmarketing.today/027. And I know you've heard this already multiple times. This is the third episode I mentioned this, but I've started doing live recordings of podcasts where you get to listen in live and you get to ask questions to my guests live on show. So I have VP of Growth at Spotify, CEO of Mixergy. I have other top growth people in the industry coming on, so you don't want to miss it. If you want to catch a next live recording, you can check it out at growthmarketing.today/live. Other than that, here is my chat with Nick. Hey, everyone. We have here Nick Drew, CEO of Fuse Insights. How are you doing, Nick?
I'm doing well, thank you. It's Friday, so I'm looking forward to the weekend.
Oh man, it's kind of cold here in Toronto, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Every winter or every fall, we get to this thing of like, oh crap, I'm not ready for the cold.
You're not from Canada, right? You're originally...
No, so I grew up in England, in the UK.
Still cold.
Yeah, damp cold as well. It kind of really permeates, you know, in a way that generally Toronto winters, the good ones are kind of cold but dry.
That's good. Yeah, I'm super excited to talk about your background because you came into Red Academy to talk about data. And I feel like for growth and marketing, data and insights, a lot of people get it wrong, right? Maybe before we jump about talking about that, can you tell a little bit about your story, like how you got here to being this CEO of this data insights company?
So I, at school, I'd always found that math, you know, in North America was pretty straightforward, made a lot of sense. This idea of kind of looking at numbers and going, oh yeah, I get that. And being able to relate it to stuff that you see around you and go, oh yeah, that kind of relates to this formula, or that's how you might express it in numbers. So then after university, my first job, I worked at a market research company called TNS.
Cool.
So one of the big companies in the industry. And I was really kind of sold on this idea of taking, again, you know, gathering data, but then taking it and working out what it meant and then building a story around that, telling clients what it means and so on. Of course, the thing you forget to factor in when you're like a new graduate is that you're going to be the most junior person in the office and you're going to be doing the most boring stuff. So although it was really good that I did it and it was a solid sort of grounding in how to use data and how to generate insights, it was tough. And so I moved on from there after 3 or 4 years to join the Financial Times. We have it here. Checking. Well, it's not that huge anymore. I mean, as a brand, it's big, but in terms of the circulation, it's...
But people know of Financial Times, right?
Yeah, because their brand is so strong, what they stand for and what they represent. And so that was kind of my first move into the client side of research. So coming from working for a vendor where clients would come to us and say, look, I need to do research on, you know, our product, design it for me, going to the client side and being essentially one of the people in charge of developing the research. So working with the marketers, the product developers, the website owners, and even editorial to take their problems really and turn them into something that we could measure, something that we could give answers to, and so on. So that was, I found that a lot more interesting. And I think it was kind of that application of the skills. So not just, hey, let's do research because research is interesting, but actually research being used as a tool to more interesting or better outcomes. So from there, I joined Microsoft.
Oh, wow.
And
everybody knows Microsoft.
Yeah. Specifically on the online side. So MSN, as was, Bing, Hotmail, and so on. And doing essentially the same kind of work, like really working to understand consumers,
right,
their behaviors, their attitudes. And, you know, obviously in the world of what then was relatively new tech of mobile phones and how that was changing behavior and so on. And, you know, it was more of the same kind of stuff that I really enjoyed of combining a piece of research with what we already knew or what we could find elsewhere about specific audiences or trends and so on. I moved over to Canada in 2010 and joined Yahoo. So
okay,
kind of a lateral.
So Microsoft, Yahoo.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, to be honest, there's a lot of overlap there in the roles. And in fact, now when you look at the online publishers in Canada, you see that their research teams and what their research teams are doing are actually quite similar in a number of ways. A lot of it, again, is focusing on understanding how consumers are interacting, how their products are playing a part in helping facilitate sales and so on. So I was at Yahoo and I was head of research for a few years. I was also responsible for the research in Latin America as well and worked on a few projects there and went to Rio and Sao Paulo and Mexico wow. City to present stuff, which was, that was pretty cool.
Big time.
Well, yeah, because, you know, I mean, the sad fact is that, and I know I've mentioned it when we've spoken before, research just isn't that exciting as an industry. People don't talk about like, oh my God, market research, like it's so cool.
Right.
They're doing such amazing stuff.
Yeah.
But being on a stage, like presenting to a group of Brazilian advertisers with simultaneous translation going on was like, holy cow, this is pretty cool. So from there, I spent some time working in the PR space, which at the time was quite intriguing. PR agencies around the world actually are realizing that where traditionally they've not focused hugely on the skills required for research or data analysis, you know, PR has been traditionally about telling stories in engaging ways. They're now realizing that they're having to up their game in terms of showing they're working, showing the proof points behind the story. Consumers are getting more cynical and less credulous, I suppose. And clients as well are now demanding to know, listen, you've suggested this thing. Why is it a good idea?
Right.
So I set up the research and analytics function for Fleischmann Hillard, which is a multinational PR agency based out of St. Louis. I was responsible for the Canadian kind of function there and building it as something that Fleischmann did. And that was, maybe we'll come back to it, but that was a really interesting challenge, kind of, you know, taking research into a space where it's not really been used very much before in a good way and trying to essentially change people's ways of working to say, look, we have to incorporate insight. We have to take a step back and understand the audience and so on. So that was a lot of time that I'd spent on the client side of research. But I obviously started out on the agency side, the vendor side. And that's something that I had aspirations, I guess, for a number of years of returning to and setting up an agency based on what I learned as a client and what my needs were when I was a client. And so that's what I did last year with Fuse Insights, setting up this boutique research and analytics agency to help clients, obviously doing kind of the conventional type of research stuff of, listen, we need a survey of our users to see what they think of us, but also taking that kind of more in-depth understanding of what a research client needs and what, to be honest, their stakeholders need help with to really help them do better with the research and the data and get further with it. And I guess get, you know, better impacts from that.
Interesting. That's awesome. That's great to hear you have this diverse experience from client and also agency side. Now, my background is in startups. We were just chatting about that. And I find a lot of people get data wrong, right? They misinterpret it, like you've noticed, but they also don't dive further into insights. Mm-hmm. Why do people get data wrong so often?
So I think from what I've seen, and this may not be all of it, but I see probably two themes most commonly. One of them was something that I picked up on very early in my career, was the first time that I went to work at the Financial Times, actually. And people would say to me, oh, I couldn't do what you're doing. And at that point, what I was doing was just looking at a set of tables or some data based on, you know, the number of readers and what demographics they had and so on. And at the time, I was intrigued by it, but I thought it was quite cool because obviously, you know, your job's never in danger if people think you do something that they have no idea how to do.
You're the magician.
Yeah, exactly. That thing of like, there we go, there's the answer. But there is, and it's something, the more that I kind of worked and came across it, the more I realized that traditionally there has been this divide of people who see themselves as comfortable with data and then those who think about data and go, oh, I wouldn't understand it. Mm. And it's not the same as saying, I don't understand it. It's more, oh no, I wouldn't know what to do with it. I think that that's changing. There is definitely more of a focus, as you've touched on, you know, in startups, in marketing, in PR and comms, in strategy. There is this recognition that, listen, everything has to be backed up with data, and saying that you don't know how to do it just isn't good enough.
You know, yeah, the future of careers and jobs really is getting more data driven.
So that's kind of the first big theme. And I mean, we do still see it, and PR agencies are one example of those who have traditionally been in that space and are trying to pivot to be more au fait or comfortable with data. The other one is, and I scribbled down a note, is thinking that seeing data is like this magic bullet. Mm. So, you know, kind of, we have a business challenge. So let's go and get the data and then that'll tell us what to do.
Wow.
And it's only half right. Because yes, you go and get the data and then stuff happens in the middle and then it gives you the answers. But it's the stuff happening in the middle that traditionally I've seen people perhaps being surprised by or not expecting. So this idea of, well, if we get the right data, then we, you know, it'll be obvious. We won't have to put any more effort into thinking about it. And actually, that's not really the case.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, honestly, if you survey 100 people, you're going to get 2 or 3 different possible explanations for their behavior or their attitudes. And so you really do have to kind of sit down with the data and look through it. Depending on the complexity of it, you may have to spend more time thinking about it or finding more corroborating insights. If it's something quite simple, it could just be a case of sitting for half an hour and thinking about what it means and what to do with it. But this idea that if we gather enough data, then that'll give us all the answers is misguided. And I think that that's something that hasn't yet changed. I think there is still this belief of, you know, we've gathered data and it hasn't given us the answer. Let's gather more data.
Wow.
Rather than saying, okay, well, let's take a second look at the data and work out, you know, what we're missing or what it is telling us or and so on.
That's so good. Like, there's the missing piece in the middle where you got data and then there's the insight at the end or actions. And I think the magic is in the middle where a lot of people don't expect to see what's in there in the middle.
And one thing that, I mean, I've seen, I guess, both sides of it. And traditionally, again, I mean, this is changing a lot, but traditionally a research agency gets as far as the data part and goes to the client, there you go, there's the data. in bar graphs and tables, this is what you need. The client's stakeholders are there saying, well, we need the answers. And so it's this, you know, this bit in the middle traditionally has fallen between the two stools. And that's one of the major reasons why I knew that there was an opportunity for an agency that actually kind of went further and said, look, we're not just going to leave you with the numbers and leave you to sort it out yourself because, frankly, you don't have time and you don't want to be doing that amount of work.
So that's where I'm curious about the middle part. What is your process there from here's a lot of data, here's your process, and then here's, you know, the insight. What does your process look like right now?
I wish I had like an easy kind of step-by-step plan because, as you say, it depends on the data and so on. But I mean, for me personally, what I like to do typically is read. Like, I read a ton of stuff just in general as well. And so when it comes to data, I'll be sat there reading through it and thinking about it and looking at, you know, for example, if it's a survey, okay, well, do people's answers differ depending on their age? Yes, maybe it does, or no, it doesn't. Does it differ by income? Does their answer to this question here about how much media they consume relate to their answer over here about how much they trust different channels? First of all, I guess, looking at the top line numbers and just understanding essentially the headlines of, okay, well, what is it saying? If I had to describe in, you know, 5 lines what it says, what are those? And then going beyond that and saying, and really thinking about, okay, but does that differ by groups, or does that contradict what I thought it would say, right, or does it agree with what I thought it would say? Is there other stuff that I've read that corroborates it or correlates with that? I mean, then it becomes kind of just a curiosity thing.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say, is like, you're talking about curiosity, about asking questions and asking what and why.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I mean, that's something that I think doesn't get asked enough in some of the places that I've seen where people are dealing with data, is people are looking at the data and they're not asking those questions. They're not asking, okay, well, why would this be? And I think it's that there that really kind of starts to get you to the insights of, okay, well, people really dislike this flavor.
Right.
Why is that?
Right.
Well, actually, it's because, like, one thing I've noticed, it's kind of a trivial but funny thing. So in the UK, chip flavors they're kind of meaty flavors. So you get steak and beef and bacon and chicken, okay, and prawn and so on. Have you noticed that in Canada, all the chip flavors are, they're all kind of sauces?
Yeah.
So it's like all dressed and sour cream and chive and barbecue sauce. Ketchup. And so on. Yeah, exactly. And it's that kind of thing that, you know, that curiosity kind of spills over to there.
Right.
And then, you know, random things like that that you notice sort of day to day then also permeate back into what you're looking at. For me, at least, I've done enough work kind of understanding consumers and understanding their motivations. I think that that curiosity does kind of carry through of, okay, well, people are weird. What motivates them in this space, or how do they think in that way, and so on. And again, you know, given a data set, it's like, well, what does this tell us about people that we didn't already know? Or about the brand, or, you know, whatever we're exploring. I realize that's not best step-by-step answer, but
I think if you gave me a step-by-step, then it would be like, oh, it's that simple. But it is vague, and there's got to be uncertainty and this box of not knowing. And that's where, you know, innovation or insight comes from, is this mess.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, you know, we're always told that we need to look for the insights.
Right.
They're only insights because we didn't previously know
them. Right, right. They're in that, like, you have a mess of clothes. You're trying to look for something. You have to pull it out of that mess.
Yeah, yeah. Right? And I mean, for me, I think the one thing I would say in every data set or set of numbers or whatever, it's always asking questions about it.
Right.
That's like the single kind of biggest thing of, like, as you said, like, what, why, who, how, you know, that kind of thing. And then looking for the answers in the data, but then also in kind of what you know outside of the research.
And this gets into, like, user experience or user research, where do you ever marry data with qualitative stuff, like customer interviews or focus groups?
Yeah, it's really important.
Right. Because, like, now I find in startups, like in tech companies, they're like data, and it's quantitative data. Right. And they're like, 1 second, like, that only tells you half of the story. You should maybe do some qualitative data gathering.
And I think, I mean, there's obviously a lot of focus on the power of big data and the idea that if you track behavioral data, you can get answers for all of this. And I think that's always the thing. I mean, Google has research teams because even though they rely so heavily on their data, because they want to know the why, they want to know what people are thinking that causes them to behave in this way. And so it is very important.
Why don't teams do it? Why don't they ask the questions? One of the things I can think about in startups is time. They don't have time. They are too crunched. Their investors are pressuring them. Maybe you've seen in other places where they have data and they jump on the first thing that they find. Whereas you're probably more like, wait 1 second, is that really what the data's saying? So is there a reason why you can think of that teams don't do it?
I think in part it stems from, in some cases, from being not 100% comfortable with working with the data and with asking those questions. Because again, you know, if you come back to this idea of data is always the answer, then in a way it can sometimes seem like, well, if you probe into it too much, why would you do that? Because it already has the answers. I mean, you mentioned in startups, you see it not happening so much. Is that true? Have you found in the US as well as Canada or and other places you've worked?
I find particularly, well, when I was working in Silicon Valley, it's about speed. Speed is the biggest metric. You know, the faster you learn, more you make more money, get revenue in faster. So there's a lot of pressure on growth people to rush things or work more than 24 hours a day, right?
True.
So that's just what I find. It's like there's not enough people asking to slow down to say, hey, we need to really look at the data and ask why, ask what, how, right?
I think you've hit on something there sort of really important, which is the idea that sometimes asking those kinds of questions can be seen as being destructive or obstructive.
Wow.
You know, so this idea of, look, the answer's there right in front of us from the numbers. People like this. So I saw something today saying that a majority of Canadians want marijuana legalization to be essentially done in a similar way to how cigarettes currently sold or will shortly be sold, with plain packaging, no branding, and, you know, behind the counter and so on. And as a headline, it's gained a fair amount of traction, and you see it and you're like, okay, great. But the people who stop and go, well, hang on a minute, I want to know more about this. What's behind it? Are there people who don't want that? And so on. And that is often regarded as being kind of obstructive of just right. Like, well, why would you do that? We have the answer. We don't have the time for you to go through this and so on.
Mm. That's so true. That's a really good point to make sure you ask the right questions. Is there any other advice you would have for people who there's so much abundance in data right now, right? Like, and I'm talking about in tech startups, like there are so many tools and now there's each of those tools now have their own data set, right? Like Salesforce, there's HubSpot, there's MailChimp, there's this and that, and Google Analytics. Are there other tips that you can give to them to use data smarter?
I think the number one thing is that ultimately the data is helpful. And as you say, like you have it in all of these different sources. The thing that ties them together is the person. It's the human in the middle of them, kind of looking at the different numbers and saying, okay, well, Salesforce is telling us this and MailChimp is telling us that. Right. And even though, you know, with the development of APIs and so on, it's possible to integrate the data sources together. There's still a requirement for someone at the center of it to go, well, what does it all mean?
Right.
So that for me is the number one thing, is that a couple of reasons is that you need to have someone there taking the time to do it. One reason is because obviously they need to find the answers in the data because they don't always just come to the surface themselves. Second one is that if we don't make the case for people being at the center of that, there's going to be a lot more people out of jobs.
That's true.
If I mean, it may come eventually, but the second major thing that I would say is that, you know, data isn't really kind of this box to be ticked.
Right.
You can't, obviously, you know, when it comes to a strategy, collecting data is a key piece of it. But then there are other steps that stem from that. Of, okay, well, what did the data tell us? Does it change what we were thinking? Or, you know, do we need to gather more data and so on? What I've seen, and, you know, in kind of the comm space in particular, you see it quite a bit. This idea of we've got data, tick, we're done, move on to the next thing. And there isn't that kind of, partly because of time, there isn't that time for reflection of, okay, well, does it agree with what we say? Does it contradict what we say? Or, you know, what do we need to do as a result of it? And then I guess the third thing is that part of tied with that is this idea of, well, if data is good, more data is better.
Wow.
And so I've had I've had conversations with people talking about dashboard solutions for a client, and they were saying, well, you know, they were saying their client wanted like 50 different kind of data points in this dashboard. And so, you know, we were talking about it and I asked and I said, well, how data savvy is your particular client? Well, they're, you know, the head of insights and they have kind of a team, but they're not really data analysts. And we were talking it through, like, who's going to do anything with 50 data points that are updated every single day?
Oh, man.
So, you know, it can be difficult to do, but sometimes and often, in fact, the best insights are from far fewer data points.
Yeah.
Bringing 50 down to 5, you know, there's the various rules of thumb of like, you know, we remember, what is it, at most 7 items.
Right.
And when it comes to data, it's easier just to kind of join up 5 dots rather than 50 and work out what they're saying.
That's so true. I think you're right. You get more data and it adds complexity, and simplicity is always better, right?
But that is where it can take a lot of work of kind of going through and saying, okay, well, we have 50 data points. Exactly. Which 5 are going to be the most valuable for us going forward? And, you know, on a regular basis, looking at them again and saying, okay, well, are there others that we should include that should replace, you know, some of the ones that we have? And again, I think for me, to some extent, it comes back to, you know, it's easier just to include everything.
And it looks better for the CEO to say, yeah, we're looking at 50 data points, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's fascinating because like there's this book called Lean Analytics. It's like this holy grail for startup people in terms of data and analytics for companies. They talk about this thing called the one metric that matters. Mm-hmm. So every startup in wherever stage, whether the early stage or mid stage, mm-hmm. they should have one metric, their North Star, that they should drive towards, which kind of makes sense. As to it relates to what you're saying in terms of like, maybe you don't want to track 50 metrics because you're going to shoot yourself in the head, right?
Well, I mean, you see it as well in advertising as well. You see it a lot. There's a lot of focus at the moment in digital advertising on measurement and across media on measurement as well. Should we measure impressions or viewable reach and so on? And, you know, it comes back to, listen, you're a CPG firm. You sell diapers.
Yeah.
Your one number that matters is how many diapers you sell. Now, from there, obviously...
Right, you're going to look at the funnel, right?
Exactly. Right. So, you know, at each stage, there'll maybe be one metric that's most important of, you know, how many stores are you stocked in and how many people saw your advertising. But there should only be one or two data points at each stage.
It's true. I know this is not a question I sent you, but I'm curious what you think about AI and machine learning, about like where it's going. Because like Toronto right now, there's a huge boom in terms of AI startups and like, you know, like Uber and other companies investing into like AI companies here. What do you think the implication of AI and like future technology is to data?
I think my understanding, and not being an expert necessarily in a programming and AI field, for now, the moment, my belief is that what's widely available is very good at gathering data and aggregating data and bringing it together. I also, you know, I know that through things like, I mean, even as simple as Google Analytics, tools can bring out kind of key trends to you and say, look, as you can see, this variable here rose over time and this one went down. There is still currently a gap for the critical thinking part, I think, to be able to say, you know, okay, well, I've got these two lines. One goes like that, one goes like that.
What does it mean?
Yeah.
Right.
And I mean, that will always evolve. Well, hopefully, as long as I have a career, it will always be there. I think that it will over time evolve. You know, if you look 20 or 30 years out, and I think as well, I mean, if there's enough analysis done through...
Yeah.
programmed tools through software and so on, then the software, the AI, will have seen sufficient scenarios to say, last time we saw this pattern, it related to, you know, the seasons or the seasonality or the weather or whatever. So I think that it will get there, but it's quite a way off at the moment. I also think, of course, that what's available at the cutting edge versus what's widely available to organizations, there's a gap there
That's true.
Even with the scenarios, you said, well, this is probably seasonality. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's still got to be a person there to say, well, what does that mean for my business? Does it relate, right? There's still got to be somebody to, like you said, the critical thinking piece, still, I feel like there needs to be somebody there to make a decision for the business.
Yeah. And I mean, what does it mean to me as well? Yeah. I think that's the other thing is, I've never really kind of thought about this too much, but there is definitely kind of a piece of it. Well, what do I think of this?
Mm.
And I think, you know, not out of an egotistical thing, but given what I know about the world,
right,
does this feel right to me, or does this kind of sit right? And I mean, there's stuff, you know, gut feeling probably shouldn't be used as much, but still there is that sense, like,
there's
you
a
see
sense of knowing
you see a headline wrong. Exactly, you even see a headline in a newspaper and you're right. Like, no, that doesn't feel right, to be honest. There's something there, the way they've done the research or the way that they've described it doesn't sit with what I know of the world. You know, it's like if you saw a headline saying the sky is green, you kind of be, no, that's not
right. Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
It's kind of based, I suppose, on what you know, but also how you feel about what you know.
That's true.
It's tough to articulate or give as a plan, though.
I understand. Like, I do understand, like, not everything's going to be 100%. Like, even with data, there's still uncertainty, right? There, like, well, data says this, and then there's that piece that's uncertain. Right.
Yeah, I mean, depending on, not to get too data heavy for you, but depending on what you're looking at, you know, 56% of Canadians asked agreed with this statement. Now, depending on what it is, if it's, you know, 56% of Canadians asked agreed that Justin Trudeau would be their choice for next prime minister, that's pretty good. If it's 56% of Canadians believe that all immigration to Canada should be stopped, that's kind of different, because then you look at it, you're like, well, there's 44% who say definitely no. Or, I mean, in the case of the UK, 52% voted for Brexit. Depending on the scenario, that's either really important number or actually fairly unimportant.
That's cool.
And so, you know, being able to make a straight decision based on a single number or a series of numbers isn't always possible. It does require that element of, is this big? Is it small? Right. What are the other variables? And like I said, my understanding and belief is that AI will definitely get better at that.
It will, right.
But it's not there yet.
That's true. Let me take a step back and, like, maybe you can chat a little bit about the tools that you use. I noticed you had Excel on a little bit earlier. Well, it's like the heart, bread and butter for when I was doing my MBA was like Excel, right? And regression, there's a regression plugin. What kind of tools do you use right now?
I don't think there's anything too exciting. I mean, honestly, like, there's Excel, there's, you know, Word and PowerPoint. They're very helpful.
And your brain, right? You got to have, like, in your experience.
I tend to use paper because for me, seeing things written down on paper and the ability to just kind of scatter a ton of papers around so that you can see this data point over here in conjunction with that one there and go, oh, okay.
You're like a detective.
You're like, you're mapping out like a murder scene and you have papers around. You're trying to connect dots.
Yeah, and I mean, you can see up on the wall there as well, like all the stuff I've kind of pieced together.
Yeah, people don't see that, but there's like
sticky notes there.
Yeah. I mean, those are kind of the essential tools, the fundamental kind of stuff. And then in addition, depending on the source, there's things like SPSS, which I, you know, is university students' favorite. It's a miserable piece of software.
Yeah, I've tried it. Yeah, it's not good.
So there's that. And then, I mean, there are sort of different tools like Tableau, Harmony, and so on, which, again, I mean, essentially what they're doing is taking raw data in the forms of columns and rows and allowing you to kind of draw it up in graphs. And honestly, that's what I use a lot of Excel and PowerPoint for. Is for taking data and going, okay, well, if I look at it by, you know, if I look at responses by age or gender, what does that look like? And the reason why researchers love bar graphs so much is because it really just shows you very quickly. You're like, oh, that bar is bigger than that bar. I get it. And so you can digest it. So those are honestly the main tools. I know I've been asked a few times about sort of different dashboard solutions and so on. I don't use a huge number on a regular basis, but, you know, again, there's Tableau and Harmony for those for those visualization pieces.
Awesome. I'd like to wrap up, maybe talk about like any tips you would have for people who are trying to get into data research or analytics analysis. Your career has been awesome. What kind of tips would you have for maybe an undergrad who's about to graduate or a grad student who's about to get into the industry?
I have to say, I mean, you might not like this. It feels like the question is slightly hypothetical anyway, because again, I mean, research and data analytics are not something that I've been aware of as being, you know, having huge numbers of students going, oh my God, I want to do that. It's not a hugely aspirational right. role in as much as I understood. I think sort of stepping back a bit though, I mean, the first thing I would say is that data and analytics, or knowing how not to drown in data, is something that more and more people are going right. to have to do. And right. whether you're in marketing, in media, in advertising, in product development strategy, these are essential skills. And, you know, for graduates right. coming out now, I don't think it's acceptable really anymore. And it certainly hinders your chances to some extent, I would say, of employability. If you say, oh, I get scared by numbers, or I'm really not comfortable with them. So that's kind of the first thing, is just accepting that, listen, you've kind of got to know enough. You don't have to know how to manipulate sort of,
right.
you know, million point data sets, but at least to be able to look through.
And tell a story, would you say?
Yeah, exactly.
Tell a story from the data.
And, you know, whether it's a dashboard and go, okay, well, these are the things that I need to know.
Right.
And being able to, should, you know, a boss ever say, okay, well, what's the data saying? Being able to give at least a basic answer of things are improving, but we need to watch here. One thing I had scribbled down was specialism. I mean, it's my own personal take, and it may not necessarily represent the market, but you see a lot of this kind of reductionist right. chat about big data is going to make research redundant, or, you know, I mean, it's that classic thing of thing X is increasing, therefore thing Y is going to disappear.
Right.
It's the argument that says cable TV is going to disappear completely because right. people watch Netflix. Right. In research terms, we do have some of that conversation of, you know, qualitative research is irrelevant because we have quantitative, or quantitative research doesn't matter because we have big data. At present, I would say there are still fairly clear purposes for all of them.
Right.
And so having a knowledge, a working knowledge of what the different tools are, and being able to understand why you would want qualitative, or when you would need to use quantitative survey versus using the behavioral data that you've collected on your site, that is important. And rather than saying, you know, we need nothing else because we have our site traffic data, you know, it's good to be able to know that, and it's transferable. The final thing I would say, power of three, critical thinking. So we just did some research and launched it last week about the skills that employers look for.
Interesting.
And the top three skills were critical thinking, problem solving, and I believe it was ability to communicate clearly. And two of those, critical thinking and problem solving, about 40% of employers said that they struggle to find in
wow.
new employees.
Wow.
So again, being able to, it's not always easy in a work environment to be the person who says, hang on a minute, guys, I don't think this is right. It doesn't feel right to me. But if you at least have that internal monologue or discussion of, does this feel right to me?
Right.
Yeah, kind of. And thinking about the why behind everything. Mm. Is it Simon Sinek,
right? Always start with
wrote that book yeah. of Always Start With Why. And right. in research and data, it's still incredibly valid of, here's the headline. You know, having someone in the room to say, why is that? Like, what's right. caused that to happen?
Right.
is incredibly helpful and leads to new ideas, leads to new insights, right. new startups even.
Right.
And so that is, I mean, it's hugely in demand, and it's something that time and again, I talk to a number of peers and friends in the industry, and they mention as being important and perhaps not always seeing in their colleagues as often as they would like in an ideal world.
That is awesome. Thank you so much. Where can people find you online? Maybe pitch your company, and what kind of companies do you work with? Do you have a blog? Anything you want to promote? This is your time.
So as I think you mentioned at the start, the company is Fuse Insights, and the website is www.fuse-insights.com. Fairly new website, actually. We do have a blog up there, and we're just kind of ramping up and getting up to speed in terms of putting new content there. In terms of the agency as a whole, like I said, I mean, really our focus is on clients who know that they need answers from research, but don't want to be left with just the data.
Right.
You know, they want their agency to help them first of all, get the data, but then do that something in the middle bit to convert it into next steps, a clear plan, a strategy, and solution for their C-suite and marketing and so on. Because again, it's really based on my own experiences of being a client and the difficulty I had in finding an agency that would really finish the work,
right,
rather than giving me 120 slides of bar graphs and saying, hey, there you go, we're done. And so at Fuse, really, you know, I think one of the lines on the website is, we'll never give you 100 slides. We'll always give you, maybe it's a white paper, maybe it's an infographic, right, but it will always have those clear implications of, here's the data, here's what it's told us, and here's what it means for you. This is what you have to go and do. This is how you can develop it, and so on.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Nick, for your time. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening in on this episode. One of the things that Nick said I really love is that curiosity is the key to reading data and getting insights. People are not asking enough questions. Ask why and so what. I know I've been guilty of this. I look at data, I don't have enough time, and I just go with my gut. Sometimes asking the right questions and asking more questions might lead into better decision making. Once again, if you want the high level author inputs from this episode, you can go to growthmarketing.today/027. And once again, I already mentioned this. I've mentioned this multiple times because I'm super excited about it. There's live recordings of this podcast now where you get to listen in and ask questions in real time to my guests. I mean, how great is that? It's not one-sided communication anymore. You can actually chime in and be part and be engaged in this movement or this podcast, if you so to speak. If you have any other feedback or question, send me a short email at ramley@growthmarketing.today. I love hearing from you. I respond to all my emails. Other than that, this is Ramley from Growth Marketing Today. And once again, keep on growing.